Some time ago, our family, that is, my brothers, my sister, my mom and dad were sitting around in their front room talking about mom and dad's going to heaven, that time when they'll be transferred to their eternal home. And they were talking about what they would leave behind and inheritance and all that kind of stuff. And mom said, "Now tell me, is there anything that we have that you kids specifically want?" I suppose they were thinking about their will or what have you. And my sister Nikki said, "Oh mom, don't even talk about that." And then I said, "Well, since you mentioned it, mom, actually there is one thing I would like. I would like the kitchen table." And I really would. And I kind of put my request in for that, should mom and dad be taken home before we are. That kitchen table that has been various colors at various times, painted black, then green, then cream, and in recent years been stripped down to its original oak and finished very beautifully. Round, it seats six easily, but expands to seat quite a few more if you add in the leaves. And the reason that I would like to have that table is because I have extremely fond memories. You see, in our family, every dinner time, almost inevitably, there would be discussions around that table that would go on for some time. Discussions not only about the things we did that day and family business, but more importantly, discussions about politics and philosophy and religion and Bible prophecy. And we used to talk around that table, really not infrequently, hours after dinner was over. We all have fond memories, terrific memories. I also, though, in thinking about that table, have a troubling memory. Across from me always sat my older brother, Dave. He was 6 years older. He still is. And when I was 4, 5, 6, 7, in those ages there, he would sit across from me, and inevitably, as dinner would progress on, and sometimes these discussions would unfold, suddenly, and I still to this day can't explain it totally, but I was aware that something was happening under the table, away from the sight of my mom and dad. I knew that my brother Dave's finger was pointing at me. I just knew it. You had this burning sensation of a finger's penetration going right through you, even though he was all the way across the table. And so I would look underneath, and sure enough, the finger pointing right at me. And I would cry out to my mom, "Mom, Dave's pointing at me." And she would say, "Johnny, don't worry about it. Just eat your peas. Just ignore him." And I'd go back and eat my peas some more. And then suddenly, once again, I had this sensation that under the table, the finger pointing at me. And sure enough, I looked and cried out all the more. And this would go on night after night. Usually about the third or fourth time, it was overpowering, because it wasn't, when Dave really wanted to get to me, it wasn't a single finger, it was all five. That was the big weapon, all five. And I would cry out, and oftentimes my mom and dad heard my cry and banished Dave to his room. Deliverance, victory, the finger. The fingers pointing at me. Troubling. Let me tell you, though, another finger was appearing that was even more troubling than the finger of my brother pointing at me. In chapter 5, we see the story of a finger, or should I say fingers, appearing mysteriously and writing a message to the king of Babylon, whose name was Belshazzar. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself a bit. The year is 539 BC. Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king that we have been studying about in the first four chapters, has been dead and gone for 20 years. When he died, he turned over the kingdom to his son-in-law, Nabonidus. Nabonidus had a son whose name was Belshazzar, the one talked about in chapter 5. Nabonidus was often away from the city of Babylon, where he was engaged in military conflicts and battles. So he turned over the day-to-day running of the kingdom to his son, Belshazzar. And so, Belshazzar, the son of Nabonidus, the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, whom we have been reading about, is now on the throne. Babylon, as we talked about last week, was thought to be absolutely unconquerable. A city that was surrounded with double walls. One of these walls was 350 feet high. Folks, that is 35 stories up. A wall around the city in its entirety. 86 feet wide was this particular wall. It was wide enough for six chariots to have races around the top of it. A huge wall. Impenetrable. And then around that wall was the Euphrates River. And then in front of the Euphrates River was a second, smaller wall. And so it would seem as though there would be no way to possibly get into Babylon. We talked about there being 250 towers strategically located upon this wall, which the soldiers in those towers could throw down spears or rocks or whatever at anyone who would be foolish enough to try and attack that city. Inside, they had supplies that would last them 20 years if necessary. That is, if anybody should besiege the city, they could lock themselves in and stay inside for 20 years without ever having to open up their gates. They felt invincible. Well, during the reign of Belshazzar, in the year 539 BC, the Medes and the Persians formed a military alliance. And these guys had the audacity to think that they could overthrow Babylon. They launched an invasion against the city of Babylon. Nabonidus wasn't around at that time. He was off on a military campaign. Belshazzar, his son, was on the throne. Belshazzar thought, this is ridiculous, the Medes and the Persians. If they think that they can actually take us on in battle, let them besiege the city. Let them surround us if they dare. They'll never get in. It's craziness. Why, they felt the Medes and Persians had as much chance getting into Babylon as the Oakland A's felt that the Dodgers were worthy of competition. No way! Dodgers wouldn't have a prayer, not with Canseco and Maguire and the Oakland Bashers. It'll be over in five games, that's what all the pundits said. Nobody can beat the A's. And they said nobody can beat the boys from Babylon. The B's. We're tougher than nails. We're safe in our walled city. So what did Belshazzar do? He called 1,000 of his leaders together, his generals, his nobles, his rulers, and he threw a party for them. A party where the wine flowed freely. Why did he do this? I believe he was showing that he wasn't worried at all about the Medes and the Persians that were now beginning to surround the city. Hey, we don't have to be fighting against them or fasting before God in fear. Let's feast. No worry, man, let's party. Often people who party and who are given to partying are trying to cover up what's going on deep inside, and that is a real worrying. That's really what most of the world's parties are about. Not wanting to deal with the reality of what's coming down, what's beginning to surround them. The fact that perhaps death is drawing closer with each day that passes. Reminded with each gray hair that appears in the beard, or each wrinkle around the eye. Hey, life is passing me by, but I don't want to worry about that old party. And so Belshazzar, trying to alleviate perhaps his own anxieties and to spite the Medes and the Persians, let's party. We read that they did just that. In verse 1 of chapter 5, he made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords or leaders, and they drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines, they drank therefrom. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God which was at Jerusalem. And the king and princes and wives and concubines drank in them. They drank wine. They praised the gods of gold, of silver, brass, iron, wood, and stone. Here they are. Years earlier, Nebuchadnezzar, in conquering the city of Jerusalem, had brought back these holy vessels taken from the temple of Jehovah. Let's fill them with wine. Let's drink out of these holy vessels, these holy cups. And not just us, but our wives and concubines. You see, this was very unusual in Babylonian culture. Unheard of. Women were never allowed at these kinds of parties, unless in that party there was a great deal of immorality. That would be the only instance where women were allowed to feast with men, was for the purpose of immorality. What do we see happening here? Using alcohol to try and forget their problems. To try and say, we're not worried about the Medes and the Persians out there. We'll use alcohol. They fell into greater problems, that is, immorality and blasphemy. Drinking out of the holy cups, they were blaspheming the true and living God. And by the way, folks, that's always what happens in those worldly settings of partying, where the booze is flowing, where drink is happening, or drugs are being used. Always the results are immorality and blasphemy. People getting looser and looser, and people getting coarser and coarser. Doing things they wished they wouldn't, and saying things they normally wouldn't. Bring out the cups. Let's drink from the cups, they said. The wine was flowing, and the blasphemy and immorality was increasing. At that time, they began to praise their gods of gold, of silver, brass, iron, wood, and stone. You say, but John, we would never do such things at our parties. We don't have gods perhaps of gold and iron. Ours are chrome and steel and rubber. I wonder how many people today on Sunday, a day given to the Lord in our culture, are home, not in fellowship, not offering worship, but rubbing their God of steel and chrome, patting Him on the belly, over and over, rubbing their God of steel and chrome and rubber. And then perhaps opening that God's mouth and bowing deeply inside, changing the spark plugs that He might sing better, run smoother. Gods of chrome and steel and rubber. Others, gods of wood and stone, as verse 4 declares. Oh, I've got to finish the siding on my god of wood as they pound in nails, saying, I don't have time to worship. I've got to work on my god of wood. Or I've got to put in that new fireplace, my god of stone. There are people, and we're all vulnerable, who are making those kinds of decisions even right now. Justifying their ignoring the true and living God, forsaking worship and assembly. Instead, rubbing their god of metal or painting their god of wood. Such things ought not to be. That's what they were doing. In this atmosphere of immorality, in this atmosphere of blasphemy, in this atmosphere of idolatry, suddenly, verse 5, came forth fingers of a man's hand. Catch the scene. I mean, here they are boogieing. Suddenly, the fingers of my brother. No. Of a greater than my brother. The fingers begin to appear. And it says, when this happened, as they began to write on the plaster of the wall in the king's palace, the king saw the part of the hand that wrote, and verse 6 says, his countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him. So that the joints of his loins were loosed. The idea there is that he was so nervous in the area of his loins that, well, I won't explain what happened, but he was extremely nervous. And it says, his knees smote one against the other. Folks, Belshazzar did not need coffee to sober him up at this point. His loins literally become like water. His knees smote together as he sees this hand writing on the wall. Boy, talk about killing the party. Suddenly, his countenance changes. People are wondering. And the king, verse 7, cried aloud, "Bring in the astrologers!" Sounds like Nancy Reagan sometimes, I'm sorry to say. And I say that jokingly, but also concerned, because you see, 15 million Americans take astrology seriously. And I want to footnote this during this particular study, that that ought not to be. Astrology is connected with Babylon, the false harlot religious system. You and I, people of God, should have nothing to do. I don't care who else is going with it. Or what people, however famous or influential they may be, are claiming to have their lives guided by it. Astrology is forbidden in the scriptures. You don't need to be following the stars. You need to be following the sun. Jesus Christ. And so, as the leader of Babylon, he cried out, "Bring the astrologers and Chaldeans and soothsayers." And the king, it says, spoke and said to the wise men, whoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet, have a chain of gold about his neck, shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. The third ruler. Of course, Nabonidus, his father being first, Belshazzar, co-ruling with his father, number two. I'll make him number three, right behind me and my father, Nabonidus. Then, verse 8, came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing, nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Belshazzar, verse 9, was greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords, they were astonished. Verse 10, now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house. And the queen spake and said, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. There is a man in thy kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of thy father, or grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, light, understanding, wisdom, and the wisdom of gods was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy grandfather, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians and astrologers and soothsayers. Verse 12, for as much as an excellent spirit of knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing hard sentences and dissolving doubts were found in this same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show you the interpretation. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The queen. Who is this queen? Not Belshazzar's wife, but rather she is the queen mother. She is the wife of Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father's wife, Belshazzar's mother. She is the daughter of King Nebuchadnezzar. And evidently, when Nebuchadnezzar was converted, as we saw last week in chapter 4, when he realized that there is a true and living God in heaven and gave himself to him, evidently, or at least very likely, his daughter also became converted because, you see, she wasn't at this party. And she was in contact with Daniel. She remembered Daniel. She said to her son, Belshazzar, listen, there's a man in the kingdom. His name is Daniel. And your grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, used him to help interpret dreams that he had. Call on him. Bring him in. You see, Daniel at this time had been out of the public eye for 20 years. Please understand this. He is now approximately 85 years of age. He had not been on the scene or really in the realm in a place of prominence since Nebuchadnezzar died. Sometimes we think, well, God isn't using me today, or this week, or this month, and we panic. That's wrong. Realize that you are a tool in the Lord's box, and He can pull you out whenever He wants to accomplish whatever He desires. And He can leave you in until He knows that you are the tool that He wants to use for that situation. You just need to be ready, be available, be open. It might not be 20 years until the Lord uses you in that big, significant way that you desire. You just keep ready and say, Lord, I'm available whenever you want to use me. That was Daniel's mindset. Off the scene, forgotten. Not in a place of prominence or visible ministry for 20 years, and suddenly he's summoned. He's brought into the palace. He was brought in before the king, verse 13 says. And he was told of the situation, and the king offered him all of these rewards and positions if he could help him out. Well, he said in verse 17, let the gifts be to thyself, and give your rewards to another. Hey, I'm not a mercenary. I'm not in this for the money. Keep your gifts, keep your rewards, but I will tell you the meaning of this handwriting on the wall. And he looked at what had been written. After giving a warning to Belshazzar, saying, Belshazzar, you have been rebellious and idolatrous and blasphemous. You didn't learn the lessons of Nebuchadnezzar, your grandfather. He had to learn the hard way. God had to humble him, or he became like a beast for 7 years, eating grass in the field, acting like an animal, until he cried out in humility to God. You didn't learn a thing. Belshazzar, you didn't learn anything from the experiences of your grandfather, and you should have known. Therefore, God has written this against you. Verse 25. This is the writing that is written there on the wall. Meeny, meeny, miny, mo. No. Meeny, meeny, tekel, you farson. Aramaic. And those there in Babylon, Belshazzar and his 1,000 lords and concubines and wives and the queen mother and all who are watching, what does meeny, meeny, tekel, you farson mean? This, verse 26, is the interpretation of the thing. Meeny, which simply means numbered. God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. In other words, your number is up. God has numbered the kingdom. Belshazzar, your number is up. Belshazzar should have known that his number would be coming up. In Psalm chapter 90, Moses declared, Lord, teach us to number our days, to realize the shortness of life. And Belshazzar should have known that in his day, that things heavy would be happening. For you see, 60 years earlier, the prophet Jeremiah came on the scene. And Jeremiah said, thus saith the Lord, thus shall you say to your masters, I have made the earth and man and beast by my great power, and I have given it to whom I desire, and I have given it, verse 6, to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. And all nations shall serve him and his son's son, and then the very time of his land shall come. Jeremiah, 60 years before, said, Nebuchadnezzar is being given an empire by me, and he shall serve it, or pardon me, all shall serve him in it, and then his son, and his son's son, but in his son's son's day, that is Belshazzar's day, things are coming down. He should have known. Your days are numbered. The handwriting is on the wall. Your days are numbered. You should have known. Secondly, tekel, verse 27, which means weighed. Thou art weighed in the balance and found wanting. Not only is your number up, but your weight is down. You're a lightweight. You were weighed in, man. And you were found wanting. You came up short. Your life, lightweight. You've been given so much, but you've done so little. And this is the day when you're called on my scales, God declared. When you're called to give an account of what you've done and you've come up short. Meanie, meanie, tekel. Your day has come. You're on the scale and you're a lightweight. Therefore, Paris, verse 28. Thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. The very ones that were presently, even that evening, surrounding the city. October 12, 539 BC. At that moment, you're broken. That's what the word divided means literally, or Paris means. You are divided, given over to the Medes and Persians. You're broken. Then verse 29 commanded Belshazzar. They clothed Daniel with scarlet, put a chain of gold about his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the land. Verse 30. This is incredible to me. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Syrians, slain. And Darius the Mede took the kingdom, being 62 years old. That night, an incredible thing happened. Listen carefully. While the party was going on, as the handwriting appeared on the wall, as Daniel was brought in saying, your number is up, your weight is down, your kingdom is broken. Something was happening that historians that were on the scene at that day still marvel at. The Medes and the Persians pulled a Tommy Lasorda. One of the greatest upsets in all of military history took place in October 539 BC. That night, exactly as was told by the prophet Daniel, but wait a minute, not just by Daniel. The general that was leading the troops, the Medes and the Persians, a man named Cyrus, who would become king, was prophesied of this very battle by the prophet Isaiah 200 years before. I'll read to you from chapter 44. Listen carefully, jot it down, perhaps look it up later, or you can look it up now if you'd like. I am the Lord that makes all things, the Lord declares in verse 24 of Isaiah 44, that saith verse 27 to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up your rivers, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Watch this, verse 1 of chapter 45. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him. I will loose the loins of kings. Does that ring a bell? I will make kings' loins loosed. And I will open two-leaved gates, or shut gates before him, and the gates shall not be shut. And I will go before thee, and make crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass, cut in sunder the bars of iron, and I will give thee, Cyrus, the treasures of darkness, the hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. Verse 4, for Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel mine elect, I have called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou knowest me not. Cyrus, you ain't even born yet. But I'm writing this down. I've named you. You are my anointed. In other words, I'm enabling you. You are the one that is going to say to my people, and we'll see him do just that. Go back and rebuild your city. Rebuild your temple. You are the one that's going to make the loins of kings loose. You are going to be the one that allows the gates to be opened. You are going to be the ones that plunders the secret treasures of an empire that was thought to be impenetrable. How did that happen? That very night in October, Cyrus and his men ingeniously diverted the Euphrates River into a lake, about a mile and a half north of Babylon. So the river Euphrates, which surrounded the city and went into the city, was suddenly dried up. And how did the Medes and the Persians then get into this city that was surrounded by a wall 350 feet high? They went in through the riverbed that was dried up because the river was diverted. It was an ingenious military plan. And guess who was leading them? Cyrus. And then as the troops went in, they opened up the gates, just like chapter 45 of Isaiah said, and the rest of the troops stormed in, and those that were inside were caught completely off guard, and Babylon fell that night. October 12th, 539 B.C., and the Medo-Persian Empire came into power. We've been talking about that on Wednesday. Incredible. The handwriting on the wall. There's a very important point, though, that I want us to see before we go our way. Listen carefully. Tune in. Lest you become like Belshazzar and miss the point of what the Lord is saying today to me, to you. Turn with me to Luke chapter 12. Jesus came on the scene and updated this story a bit. He changed the characters somewhat. And he gave us, I think, a very important and pertinent principle. Because you and I have a tendency to feel like Belshazzar. Hey, I'm secure, man. I'm young. Maybe you're only 20 or 30 or 40. I'm going to live a long time. Hey, I'm secure. I've got Social Security. I've got an insurance policy with Metropolitan Life. I'm in the stock market presently. I bank at Colonial. That's the best place you could bank, right, Dick? Right. And you might think that your thing is all tight and together, that things are all safe and secure, that your future is going to go on indefinitely. Listen to what Jesus has to say to the Belshazzars of his day and for us. In chapter 12, a great innumerable group of people were gathering around our Lord to listen to him. Verse 1 tells us that. Verse 13 says that one of the company said, "Master, speak to my brother, that he divide the inheritance with me." Nothing can cause problems like inheritance challenges and difficulties. Maybe a couple of you have been through that. I don't know. "Master, talk to my brother. The inheritance is not being divided rightly." Watch what Jesus says when they come to him saying, "Solve our problem. It's practical. It's financial." Jesus said, "Man, who made me a judge or a divider over you?" What's he saying? I didn't come. My purpose in coming was not to be a judge, a divider, a ruler in that sense, in that realm. That's not why I came. I didn't come to make bad men good or good men better. I didn't come as a financial advisor. I didn't come as a solver of disputes and problems. And I hear him saying this lovingly but firmly, man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? I didn't come to just solve these kinds of situations. Could I say this with everybody tuned in? Jesus Christ did not come to make bad men good or good men better. He came to make dead men alive. Salvation. The eternal kingdom. And those who come to Jesus and expect from Jesus that He is going to somehow make their life better or easier are missing the point of why He came. He came to die for man's sins and call us to live wholly and completely for eternity's values. He said, I'm not going to get involved in this. But how often are our prayers, Lord, help him to be nice to me. Lord, I don't have enough money. Lord, solve this dispute or this problem or this tension. How often do we come to him like this man? And does the Lord say to us, listen, that's not what I'm about. That's not why I came. You're living and praying and worrying about things earthly, temporal. And I came to usher you into the heavenly, into the eternal. Folks, it's not that he doesn't care about those problems we have. He does. But our priorities have got to be right. Then he says, verse 15, watch this. Take heed and beware of covetousness. What is covetousness? Covetousness is wanting more of what you already have enough of. And our whole society, listen, could I speak to the yuppie mentality of today? Could I speak to America in 1988? Our whole culture is built on coveting. Wanting more of what you already have enough of. One more shirt. One more car. One more guitar. One more plaything. One more toy. Why we know that the one with the most toys at the end of his life is the winner, right? Do you know the messages our society is giving out to us every day by the hundreds? You need more. Your car is out of style. Your clothes are out of style. You're out of style. You need more, man. More. Covet. And did you know that covetousness is one of the Ten Commandments, the Big Ten, that God said, thou shalt not? We think, oh yeah, well, there's the biggies, adultery and murder, and even bearing false witness or lying. But we have become totally immune from listening to the convicting voice of the Spirit about coveting. And so we adjust our lifestyles. We sacrifice our priorities to get more and more of what we already have. And families suffer. And kids are neglected. And problems abound in our culture because we have to have more. It's coveting. I can't be home, Dad says. I've got to go on one more business trip. I've got to make one more buck. And if my kids never see me or if my wife is never with me, that's tough. I've got to have more. It might not be money, it might be power, it might be success, it might be prestige in your occupation. I don't know what it is that you're coveting, but coveting is a commandment. And guess what? Listen here. In the book of Exodus, when the Lord gave the Ten Commandments, it says He gave them unto Moses, the two tablets written with the finger of God, Exodus 31. What is it? The same finger that said, Meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin, Belshazzar. The same finger that says, your number is up. You're a lightweight. And your kingdom is now taken from you, Belshazzar. You felt so secure. You've lost it all. That same finger wrote earlier on the stone tablet, according to Exodus 31, the last verse therein, Thou shalt not covet. Do not live for things. A commandment of God that is equal with not committing adultery or not killing people murderously is don't live for things. And yet, we don't hear that, folks. Our culture says, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Thou shalt not covet. The finger of God writes on the wall of your house, your temple today, and my house and my temple today. You are not to covet. And Jesus says, verse 15, take heed and beware. He doesn't say take heed and beware of adultery. Take heed and beware of murdering. No, He hears this heart of mankind worrying about inheritance and money and things. He says, take heed. Be careful in this area of coveting, particularly. Don't covet. For a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. Every American should have that underlined. Your life does not consist in the things that you possess. We don't believe that. You know what the Greeks said? When the gods want to punish a man, they will answer his prayers. Because you see, when your prayers are answered, oh, if I just had that new car, I would be so happy. Well, God just may give you that new car. And there's only one thing worse than not getting what you're coveting, and that's getting what you're coveting. You know why? Because it's never what you thought it would be. It never is. Never. I know I would be happy if I just had that car. And you get that car. And it gets out of a line, or my wife, you know, you may have saw us talking over here, she said, Johnny, they promised me you wouldn't get mad, but I bashed the bender in coming in tonight, the fender coming in today. Tammy, they lied. It's never what you think. It never is what you hoped. Oh, it might be for a day or a month or a little while, but you junk it. You know what? Today's used car was yesterday's prize and is tomorrow's junk heap. Take a good drive regularly to an old wrecking yard and look around and realize that most of those cars were being driven by someone who at one time thought, this is going to really make me happy. And they went into debt, and they worried, and they worked, and they sacrificed important values to get that car, and guess where it is today? On the heap. Listen to what Jesus says. The finger of God written in the stone given to Moses, Jesus reiterating, saying, don't covet, take heed, watch out. Belshazzar, you're living for the wrong things. Your number is up. Your palace is stuffed. Your vaults are full, but Belshazzar, tonight is the night you're on the balance and you're found wanting. Then Jesus, verse 16, spoke a parable saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. A certain farmer, not a bum, not a drug dealer, not a lottery winner, but an industrious, hard-working farmer was out, and he was productive in what he was doing. A hard worker. And he was enjoying the rewards of his labor, honest labor. Verse 17, he thought within himself, what shall I do? I have no more room to bestow my fruits. Ah, he said, verse 18, this will I do. I will pull down my barns and will build greater barns. And there will I bestow all my fruits and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, I like that, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Verse 20, but God said unto him, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided? So is he that layeth up treasure for himself, but is not rich toward God. Heavy. Fool. Here, a leader in his community, rich and wealthy, living in the finest house out in the country, doing well financially, working hard, industriously. And he says, you know, I've done good. What am I going to do? I'm going to make better investments. I'm going to tear down these old barns and build bigger barns still. And society, Wall Street and Madison Avenue, would applaud him. But God says, you're a fool. Tonight, your soul is required. You're dying tonight. You're moving on into eternity, and you have not been rich toward me. Tragic. You know why chess is such a popular game? Throughout the ages, in every country, I think it has something to do with the pieces. The queen moves wherever she wants to. The bishop can move diagonally across the board. The knight can jump. The pawns, they're not so powerful. They can just move two spaces initially and one thereafter. And I think life is like a chess game. A lot of us feel like we're pawns, just kind of plugging away a bit. Some are tricky. They're knights. They can jump and make things happen. Others are rooks. They move in straight lines. Bishops, diagonally. I could say things about that, but I won't. Queens, wherever I want to go, that's what I'll do. And I think there's this innate fascination or relating to, yeah, those pieces are like my life, or like what I want to be anyway, and I'll move and I'll get in positions and I'll power my way into victory. But next time you play chess, please remember that as you relate to those pieces on the board, they all end up in the same pine box. When the game is over, whether you're a pawn or a knight or a queen, or even the king himself, it goes in the same box and it's closed tight. And that's life. You listen, folks. Preacher, that's life. You all end up in the same place. That is, you are all going to die. Unless the rapture happens, in which you're still moving into eternity, only in a different methodology.
You are all going to leave your cars, your houses, your portfolios, your wardrobes. You're going to leave it behind. And if you think that the one with the most toys wins is true, you're a fool. That's what Jesus said. Because this rich man, I'm sure when his funeral happened, that people stood up and said, oh, wasn't he a leader in our community? Yes, yes, yes. Wasn't he benevolent in our projects? Oh, he was wonderful. But off he gets carried in his box and dropped down into the grave. And his tombstone might have poetry from some philosopher of his day or some cleverly phrased words, but the Lord comes by and says, no, on his tombstone is written, fool. He was a fool because he was not rich towards God. That was not the priority of his life. He built bigger and bigger barns, but had no time for God. Meanie, meanie, tekel, upharsin, Belshazzar, fool. You're partying, you're palacing, but tonight you're dying, and you've come up short. You're a fool. The finger of God, writing in Exodus, thou shalt not covet. The finger of God, writing in Daniel, you are found in the balances and you are wanting. Where does that leave me? Jesus Christ comes on the scene and says, the same thing is true today. You are a fool if you are not rich towards God, loving God, obeying God, living for God, walking with God. You are a fool. Because you'll end up face to face with Him. One more thing, though, before we go. The finger of God appears yet one more time. They caught her in the very act of adultery. They brought her before the rabbi of Galilee. Not because they cared about her, but so that they might entrap him. Master, the law declares that she should be stoned. What sayest thou? Jesus knew the law and their interpretation that indeed she should be bound with ropes, gagged with a towel, placed into a pit that was 3 feet deep in cow dung manure, and stoned until she fell face forward. That was their interpretation of the law. Master, the law says she should be stoned, but what do you say? Because if he said, free her, they would accuse him of being a law violator. If he said, stone her, they would accuse him of being no friend of the sinner. And it says there in the 8th chapter of John's Gospel that Jesus stooped down and with his finger, the same finger that wrote, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not bear false witness, the same finger that said, meanie, meanie, tekel, upharsin, that same finger is now writing in the ground. And it says that they watched him write, and as he was writing, he looked up and said, let he who was without sin cast the first stone. And then he continued on again. And they dropped their rocks, beginning at the eldest and going to the youngest, until there was not a single person left except for the woman herself. Woman, he said, where are thine accusers? And she said, no man accuses me, Lord. What was he writing in the ground that would cause them to drop their rocks and go their way? I suggest to you, Jeremiah, I think, hints at it in chapter 17. He was writing their sins, those that held those rocks. Their names, with dates and places and reminders that they were sinners. And they left as they saw their names being written. No doubt, one fella first perhaps seeing his name written initially. And another name or place or time or situation beside it said, I got to get going. My wife is waiting for me at home. I'll see you boys later. And he dropped his rock, and then another was written, and he also left, and one after the other. The same finger that indicted was now liberating and freeing. No man accuses me. Then he said, neither do I accuse you. Go your way and sin no more. I love it. Even though you've broken the laws I've written in stone, you're forgiven. Go your way. And I am freeing you to sin no more. Empowering you from this day on, you don't have to walk in that kind of lifestyle ever again. You're free. You see, I am a coveter. I have fought with covetousness. I have violated all of the laws, either directly or in spirit. The finger of God writes against me. But I have come to Jesus Christ. And I have said, Lord, thank you for that finger that also wrote in the ground, freeing the woman caught in the very act of adultery who came to you, brought before you, listened to you, and heard from you. Go your way. I don't condemn you. Sin no more. And so too he will say to all of us today, go your way. Those of you who believe in Christ, listen carefully. Colossians chapter 2 says, the list of ordinances written against you have been blotted out on the cross. When he died, the blood spilled right down that list. You're free. You're free. If you'll believe it and receive it and say, Lord, from this time on, I'm walking with you. I'm not going to be a fool building my own palace, throwing my own parties, living for my career, my success, my weird insecurities. From now on, I will be rich toward you. Lord, you gave everything for me. Now I am giving myself to you. You are the Lord. You are my God. And he will say, you're free. Go your way. The very hand that wrote against you also died for you. If you believe it, you are free and at liberty this day. Walk in it. Enjoy it. The finger of God, which at one time indicted you, is now liberating you. Will you allow him to? Shall we pray? Father, are we like Belshazzar, not learning the lessons from those that have gone before us? Have we been the fool, Father, not heeding your word? One night soon, you are going to be greeted. And that messenger of God is going to say, tonight is the night.
your earthly kingdom is broken. Your houses and your cars and your career, no more. Oh, you'll say, I wasn't expecting you. I'm only 42 or 28 or 17. I wasn't expecting you. Why didn't you warn me? And he will say, but I did. In the amphitheater, October 22nd or 23rd. I did with the obituary that you read in the newspaper last week. I did at the funeral of your grandmother. I did when you looked into the mirror and you saw that your body was aging. I warned you daily that the time was coming. But you were a fool, building bigger barns. I wonder today how many would say, I've played the fool, man. Today I want to get right with the Lord. If you're a believer here, you need to take a decision today. Make a decision. Take a step. By simply saying, Lord, I'm taking seriously the commandment not to covet. Not to build my empire. But live for you. I want to be rich in you, Lord. You'll have the priority of my time, my energy, my life. Lord, I want to know you. And I give myself to you. And I thank you, Lord, for the times I failed over and over again. Yet, you were there, forgiving me with the blood that you shed on Calvary. And I will love you forever, Lord, because of your blood, which constantly cleanses me from sin.